Chapter 42. The Duke of Damnation for our poor rear, by the look on't. First deserter, yes, he'll make 'em rub their poor rears before he has done with 'em. But we must overtake 'em tomorrow by a cross cut, please God. Napoleon, pointing to the dispatches, here's matter enough for me, Duke, and to spare. The ominous contents are like the threats the ancient prophets dealt rebellious Judah. Austria we soon shall have upon our hands, and England still is fierce for fighting on, strange humor in a conquered loving land. So now I must to Paris straight away at least, to Valladolid, so as to stand more apt for couriers than I do out here in this far western corner, and to mark the veerings of these new developments, and blow a counter breeze. Then too, there's lands, still sweating at the siege of sullen Zaragoza as twere hell. Him I must further counsel, how to close his twice too tedious battery. You, then, Soult nay is not yet, I gather, quite come up? Soult, he's near, sire, on the Benevent road, but some hours to the rear I reckon, still. Napoleon, pointing to the dispatches. Him, I'll direct to come to your support in this pursuit and harassment of more wherein you take my place. You'll follow up and chase the flying English to the sea. Bear hard on them, the bayonet at their loins. With Merle's and Mermet's corps just gone ahead, and Delibert's, and Hewdlett's here at hand. While Lorges and La Houssaye's picked dragoons will follow, and Franceschi's cavalry. Today I am writing, in case of need, he will support with Marquand and Matthew. Your total thus of 70,000 odd, 10,000 horse, and cannon to 50, should near annihilate this British force, and carve a triumph large in history.
He bends over the fire and makes some notes rapidly.
I move into Astorga, then turn back,
though only in my person do I turn,
and leave to you the destinies of Spain. Spirit of the years, more turning may be here than he design. In this small, sudden, swift turn backward, he suggests one turning from his apogee.
The characters disperse, the fire sinks, and snowflakes and darkness blot out all.
Scene 3, before Coruna,
the town, harbor, and hills at the back, are viewed from an aerial point to the north, over the lighthouse known as the Tower of Hercules, rising at the extremity of the tongue of land on which La Coruna stands, the open ocean being in the spectator's rear. In the foreground the most prominent feature is the walled old town, with its white towers and houses, shaping itself aloft over the harbor. The new town, and its painted fronts, show bright below, even on this cloudy winter afternoon. Further off, behind the harbor now crowded with British transports of all sizes, is a series of low broken hills, intersected by hedges and stone walls. A mile behind these low inner hills is beheld a rocky chain of outer, and loftier heights, that completely command the former. Nothing behind them is seen but gray sky. Dumb show, on the inner hills aforesaid the little English army a pathetic 14,000 of foot only is just deploying in two line. Hope's division is on the left, Baird's to the right. Paget with the reserve, is in the hollow to the left behind them, and Fraser's division still further back shapes out on a slight rise to the right. This harassed force now appears as if composed of quite other than the men observed in the retreat insubordinately straggling along like vagabonds. Yet they are the same men, suddenly stiffened and grown amenable to discipline by the satisfaction of standing to the enemy at last. They resemble a double palisade of red stakes, the only gaps being those that the melancholy necessity of scant numbers entails here and there. Over the heads of these red men, is beheld on the outer hills the 20,000 French, that have been pushed along the road at the heels of the English by Soult. They have an ominous superiority, both in position and in their abundance of cavalry and artillery, over the slender lines of English foot. The left of this background, facing Hope, is made up of Delibert's and Merle's divisions, while in a deadly arc round Baird, from whom they are divided only by the village of Olvina, are placed Mermet's division, La Houssaye's, and Lorges' dragoons, Franceschi's cavalry, and, highest above all, a formidable battery of 11 great guns that rake the whole British line. It is now getting on for 2 o'clock, and a stir of activity has lately been noticed along the French front. 3 columns are discerned descending from their position, the first towards the division of Sir David Baird, the weakest point in the English line, the next towards the center, the third towards the left. A heavy cannonade from the battery supports this advance. The clash ensues, the English being swept down in swathes by the enemy's artillery. The opponents meet face to face at the village in the valley between them, and the fight there grows furious. Sir John Moore is seen galloping to the front under the gloomy sky. Spirit of the Pities, I seem to vision in San Carlos's garden, that rises salient in the upper town, his name, and date, and doing, set within a filmy outline like a monument, which yet is but the insubstantial air. Spirit of the years, read visions as conjectures, not as Moore. When Moore arrives at the front, Fraser and Paget move to the right, where the English are most sorely pressed. A grape shot strikes off Baird's arm. There is a little confusion, and he is borne to the rear, while Major Napier disappears, a prisoner. Intelligence of these misfortunes is brought to Sir John Moore. He goes further forward, and precedes in person the 42nd Regiment, and a battalion of the guards who, with fixed bayonets, bear the enemy back, Moore's gestures in cheering them being notably energetic. Pursuers, pursued, and Sir John himself pass out of sight behind the hill. Dumb show ends. The point of vision descends to the immediate rear of the English position. The early January evening has begun to spread its shades, and shouts of dismay are heard from behind the hill over which Moore and the advancing lines have vanished. Straggling soldiers cross in the gloom.
First straggler, he's struck by a cannonball, that I know, but he's not killed, that I pray God Almighty. Second straggler, better he were. His shoulder is knocked to a bag of splinters. As Sir David was wounded, Sir John was anxious that the right should not give way, and went forward to keep it firm. First straggler, he didn't keep you firm, howsomever. Second straggler, nor you, for that matter. First straggler, well, 'twas a serious place for a man with no priming horn, and a character to lose, so I judged it best to fall to the rear by lying down. A man can't fight by the regulations without his priming horn, and I am none of your slovenly anyhow fighters. Second straggler, nation, having dropped my flint pouch, I was the same. If you'd had your priming horn, and I my flints, mind ye, we should have been there now. Then, 40 hoary, that we are not is the fault o' government for not supplying new ones from the reserve. First straggler, what did he say as he led us on? Second straggler, 42nd, remember Egypt. I heard it with my own ears. Yes, that was his strict testament. First straggler, remember Egypt. Ay, and I do, for I was there, upon my salvation, here's for back again, whether or no. Second straggler, but here. 42nd, remember Egypt, he said in the very eye of that French battery playing through us. And the next omen was that he was struck off his horse, and fell on his back to the ground. I remembered Egypt, and what had just happened to, so thorough well, that I remembered the way over this wall. Captain Hardinge, who was close to him, jumped off his horse, and he and one in the ranks lifted him, and are now bringing him along. First straggler, nevertheless, here's for back again, come what will. Remember Egypt. Hurrah! Exit first straggler. Second straggler ponders, then suddenly follows first. Enter Colonel Anderson and others hastily.
An officer, now fetch a blanker. He must be carried in.
Shouts heard.
Colonel Anderson, that means we are gaining ground. Had fate but left this last blow undecreed, the hour had shown a star amid these girdling days of gloom.
Exit. Enter in the obscurity 6 soldiers of the 42nd bearing Moore on their joined hands. Captain Hardinge walks beside and steadies him. He is temporarily laid down in the shelter of a wall, his left shoulder being pounded away, the arm dangling by a shred of flesh. Enter Colonel Graham and Captain Woodford.
Graham, the wound is more than serious. Woodford, far. Right for a surgeon, one of those, perhaps. Who tend Sir David Baird?
Exit Captain Woodford.
His blood throbs forth so fast that I have dark fears he'll drain to death ere anything can be done. Hardinge, I'll try to staunch it since no skill's in call.
He takes off his sash and endeavors to bind the wound with it. Moore smiles and shakes his head.
There's not much checking it. Then rent's too gross. A dozen lives could pass that thoroughfare.
Enter a soldier with a blanket. They lift Moore into it. During the operation, the pommel of his sword, which he still wears, is accidentally thrust into the wound.
I'll loose the sword that bruises you, Sir John.
He begins to unbuckle it.
Moore, no. Let it be. One hurt Moore matters not. I wish it to go off the field with me. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.